just realized I missed my sister's birthday. I am a bad sister. It was a couple of days ago. I'm a little slow. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1089, and we do have a quorum. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Senators Gordley, Senators Carter, Representative Boquist, Representative Buckley, come on out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1089 requires the Oregon Investment Council and the State Treasurer to divest all investments in the Republic of Sudan and in companies that do business in the Republic of Sudan or engage in other activities related to the Republic of Sudan.
And I see Senator Westland signed up on the sheet. He's sort of an honorary member of this committee anyway, so we'll look forward to his attendance. I really did miss my sister's birthday.
You're in deep, dude.
I know. Good morning, Senator Carter.
What's your sister's name?
Julie.
Oh, happy birthday, dear Julie. Kate says happy birthday to you. Does that ease it a little bit?
Yes. I'm going to get that tape and send it to her.
You know, I was claiming you were working on the medical marijuana bill.
Exactly. It slipped my mind.
Please, Fariola's peace off. Good morning, Madam Chair and colleagues of the Rules Committee. I'm Margaret Carter, State Senator from District 22. Thank you for allowing us to have expressions on this bill this morning. I would be remiss if I were not to say to you that Representative Buckley and Representative Boquist have been working on this for some time, and they get it. We're here this morning, and I'd like to reference 20 years ago this legislative session as a member of the House. I introduced House Bill 2000, and it was divestments from South Africa because of what was happening there. And the sky did not fall, colleagues, let me tell you that, in terms of our divestments in that country. As a matter of fact, I think Senator Brown, you recall that we took a picture with Mr. Tutu, Reverend Tutu, and he was thanking Oregon just 4 years ago, 2 years ago, for playing a major role in that country in terms of divestments. So I never thought I would have to, you know, to again rise to the specter of divestiture in this chambers anymore. Unspeakable atrocities are taking place in Sudan. The Congress of the United States, the President, and National Black Caucus of State Legislators have now declared that genocide, murder, torture, sexual violence, and mutilation of women and children, abductions are occurring in a massive and systematic manner in Sudan. The President of these United States gets it, and he did something about it. That genocide is being targeted at the people in the Darfur province, primarily against non-Arab ethnic groups known as the Zirga of the black population. The states of Louisiana and Illinois have acted. So has the state of California. The Senate and House in New Jersey have sent a bill to the governor. Divestiture legislation has been introduced in the halls in Boston and the Senate of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Indiana, again, California, Vermont, Texas, New York, North Carolina, Ohio have all introduced bills. Harvard, in its conservative natures and massive endowment, has divested from PetroChina in the Sudan. Stanford has divested from PetroChina and entities in the Sudan. I do not think we can go home in silence to the genocide that is occurring. Thousands of women and children have been abducted and enslaved. Children have been mutilated. Let me quote from Human Rights Watch. Militias backed by the government are committing crimes against humanity. Using indiscriminate aerial bombardment, militia and army raiding and denial of humanitarian assistance in that country. The government of Sudan and allied militia are implementing a strategy of ethnic-based murder, rape, and forcible displacement of civilians in Darfur. Senate Bill 1089 is modeled on adopted state law already. Divestment is a drastic step, Madam Chair and colleagues, and should not be taken lightly, and I do not take it lightly. However, Madam Chair and colleagues, 4 decades of murder, rape, famine, and displacement is beyond drastic. It's final. It is death for over 2 million people already, and to some, a loss of dignity, as we saw in South Africa. Colleagues, I thank you for hearing me this morning. For the first time in its history, the Committee on Conscience of the United States Holocaust Museum has declared a genocide emergency in the Sudan. Oregon also has a conscience, and that is why I'm here today, asking you to act on that level of consciousness. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, Representative Peter Buckley, House District 5. I greatly appreciate your willingness to hear this bill this morning. I'll do my best to be brief. There's a human rights crisis taking place in the country of Sudan.
No, man.
We have a chance to respond to this crisis on behalf of our state. I believe it's our obligation as legislators and Oregonians to do so. This bill, at the bottom line, calls attention to the genocide being conducted by the government of Sudan and declares our state's absolute opposition. This bill uses an Oregon model of response to this crisis, the removal of any possible financial support that's propping up an immoral and murderous government. In the 1980s, millions of Americans succeeded in accomplishing a singular achievement, ending South Africa's apartheid regime. That divestment campaign taught Americans a valuable lesson about the influence of public investments and brought national attention to the South African situation. It's now time to focus the same kind of attention and financial pressure on the Republic of Sudan. The U.S. Congress has confirmed that the Sudanese government is waging a genocidal war against its own citizens. The government silences dissent. Women and girls are being raped as an organized method of attack. Children are being mutilated. Villages are burned. Tens of thousands of people have been murdered. And it's estimated that close to 2 million people have been displaced. It's all taking place because of religious hatred and because there's oil under their land. It's time for Oregon to say no more. We will not invest our money in companies that do business with the government of Sudan. The state's public employee retirement system holdings totaled $46.6 billion as of March 31st. Sudan-related investments through the Oregon Investment Council comprise an estimated 1.5% of the state's portfolio. The reallocation of this small percentage of the state's funds will have little, if any, impact on the state of Oregon, but will have a major impact on the Sudanese government's ability to wage genocide. Our bill follows a proven model that works for Oregon, a timetable and process that allows for fiscally responsible, clearly defined steps to remove investments from companies doing business in Sudan and invest those dollars in other companies offering similar returns on our investments, but returns untainted by the blood of the Sudanese people. I was asked by a colleague recently about mixing morality with financial investments, since the clear duty of the Investment Council is to gain the highest possible return on its investments. He asked me, where do we draw the line? To me, that line is clear. We draw the line at genocide, and we do it in a way that has been proven to work to meet both our fiscal and moral responsibilities. I ask for your support for this bill. We can all work together at the end of this session to do something important and right. Oregon can join with an ever-increasing number of states who are now working to disinvest and have an impact in Sudan. The horrific attacks on the people of Sudan must stop, and we must take action now. At the current rate, another 330 Sudanese will die today. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gordon.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Avelle Gordley, and I represent Senate District 23. I would first like to honor my colleagues who are responsible for bringing this measure forward. I would first like to honor Senator Margaret Carter, who over 20 years ago was the conscience of the Oregon legislature in bringing the issue of injustices in South Africa forward. And it was Senator Carter who, working together with then-Representative Jim Hill, they were responsible for moving this legislature to act. And I want to honor the good representatives, Buckley and Boquist as well, for their deep understanding of what it is we are called to do what it is we are called to witness this morning. It was Martin Luther King Jr. who said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I would ask us to internalize that thought. And it was another powerful leader of the last century who said, power is only important as an instrument for service to the powerless. That was Lech Walesa. And I'm going to say what he said again. Power is only important as an instrument for service to the powerless. And so, Madam Chair and colleagues, I believe that we are called today to use our power and influence to make a statement that is consistent with the language that you will find on page 2 of the bill, lines 12 through 18, lines of the measure which I would like to read into the record, beginning on line 12. Genocide, enslavement, and such atrocities are repugnant to the basic principles of liberty and justice in the Bill of Rights, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, which are fundamental to the character of a free society. And reading further, Madam Chair, the investment of state trust funds and state monies in business firms and financial institutions with ties to the repressive regime in Sudan is fiscally imprudent given the political and economic instability in Sudan and inconsistent with the moral and political values of the people of Oregon. Given that statement, Madam Chair, and again, given the comments made just previously by my two good colleagues, I believe that it is our responsibility to call on our state treasurer publicly to develop a plan for the disinvestment of state trust funds and state monies in business firms and financial institutions with ties to the repressive regime in Sudan. And that is a part of our message and a part of our call to you this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. I must look like the odd couple sitting out here. I know you're going to hear the biofuels package, and they call in Representative Dingfelter and Representative Krupp the odd fellow, but I'm probably definitely the odd person out here, it would seem to you. I am Brian Boquist. I do represent a House district, and I am obviously from the other side of the aisle. You're going to hear testimony, I am sure, from the Treasury Department telling you all kinds of reasons not to do this. And I normally, as several colleagues of mine that are sitting up here, would not support this. So let me explain to you why I do. I come here from a personal background and experience in Sudan. Those of you who don't know, I've spent 30 years as an unconventional warfare officer in the active component in the reserve. And if you don't know what that is, it's a Green Beret. In the 3 decades I've worked in Africa, in 2 separate single days in the heart of Africa, the heart of the Congo, I've seen 10,000 killed in 1 day. 1 day it was the slaughter of a village, and the other day it was a cholera epidemic. In the Sudan, I saw thousands and thousands of women and children whose hands and breasts were cut off in the middle of warfare. 1 day I recall in Freetown in Sierra Leone during their civil war in 1999, where 600 women and children were put in a church and it was burnt to the ground. I didn't go to the Sudan the first time around of anything I wanted to do. Interestingly enough, a congressman named Hall, who many of you might recognize, was a close ally of William Jefferson Clinton in the Congress. Congressman by the name of Frank Wolf, a senator by the name of Sam Brownback, and John Cooksey asked us to go to the Sudan to try and figure out how we might bring the Civil War in the South to an end. That Civil War is not ending, it's in fact expanding despite the rhetoric. I have personally seen 1,000 horsemen after they finished slaughtering a village. I have personally laid on the ground as the helicopter gunships have flown over as they raise the village and kill men, women, children, and livestock. And that's not photographed, that's personal. There's 2 million dead already in South Sudan. There's over 1 million refugees from the Darfur region. I have listened to 2 administrations of rhetoric, resolutions, and speeches. And I will guarantee you, by 5 o'clock today, there will be people in Washington, D.C. that know and know factually that I testify today. And I will once again be on their less than desirable list. This war is about oil. And it is about the ECEU, who is involved there with their business companies, and it is about China, who is involved there with their oil companies. Now, we're in a war right now, whether you agree with Iraq or Afghanistan, called a war on terror. And I am on record over 2 years ago of saying that this regime is 10 times worse than Iraq ever dreamed about. Now, why is this important to Oregon and why is it different? We just saw, less than a week ago, a hostile takeover of Unocal. If you don't know the story behind that, Unocal's reserves, oil reserves, stretch throughout Southeast Asia out to the Caspian Sea. And the government of China needs oil. And so there is a hostile takeover in the process of taking over Unocal. Once they purchase Unocal, if they do, Unocal will be in the same family of companies which are with the Chinese companies that are developing the oil in Sudan. Now, they have successfully cleared Block 5, that is the entire area for the most part of the Bahr Ghazal region south of Bentiu, of anyone hostile to oil development. In that war, it was called a Christian war. That is not the case now. Now, in the Darfur region, what is systematically being done is these villages are being driven out so that there will not be any opposition to that development. And to bring it home one step closer, for those of you involved in the base closure alignments, I would love to sit down outside of this hearing and discuss with you why we are moving our aircraft out of Portland to the other side of mountains. Because it is a geopolitical issue. It has less to do with what we are doing in Portland and those airplanes and more to do of where the nuclear umbrella is. Now, I go back to my original beginning statement. I would not normally support a state involvement in a national issue, but this has come home to roost here. We have the ability ourselves to have an influence on it. We don't have to invest our state funds in companies that participate in genocide. And that's a proven fact. The United Nations, which I never agree with, has said so. The State Department has said so. Now, a picture is worth 1,000 words. These are pictures I personally took, which are before you. There's some background information in there that relates to this issue that's been passed out to you. And I'll close with, I've shared with you a document that's called Plain God in Hell that was written by, not myself, but another Special Forces officer. And if you've never been to the gates of hell like I have, read this article and you will see what it's like. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'm overwhelmed by the representative's presentation this morning and admire not only his courage but his intestinal fortitude to bring this information to us this morning. So I want to thank all of my colleagues for being here. And I'd just like to say on the record, I am personally committed to fiduciary responsibility. But I have to tell you, when we divested $800 million from South Africa and redivested those dollars someplace else, it was a pittance. I mean, very, very small. And I'm not even talking about $1 million. It's less than that happened during that particular time. So I'm hoping that today, not only will you look at this in terms of sound public policy, but I hope that your hearts will also be a part of the direction we go from here. Thank you.
Madam Chair, may I make one final comment? I have no idea what Treasury is going to say, but let me make this for the record, and if anybody doubts this, I'd be happy to provide you the documentation. American businesses are presently banned under federal law from going into the Sudan in commercial enterprises. That may change in the coming weeks. So there isn't one present development or company today. What passage of this bill will do is prevent them in the future from going in there. So everybody can tell you about the negativity of this and how it's going to impact our decisions, and that's not correct, because there are only two companies in the United States that have the legal authority to operate in Sudan right now in a commercial basis. I own one of them, and the other one is from Washington, D.C., working for the United States government. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining
Thanks.
Us.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1098. I just want to give the audience kind of a general outline of our schedule. In terms of House Bill 2078, we will be hearing that this afternoon. There's some problems with some of the amendments. 2599, Senator Ringo, I believe those amendments are not quite ready yet, so we'll be doing that this afternoon.
Madam Chair, I think we have them.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Senate Bill 1085, my understanding is there's also an additional amendment needed. I know there's folks down to testify on the bill. Are you able to be here at 1, or if you need to be here, okay, let's go ahead and do that. What else are we going to do later? I'm going to do the work session on Senate Bill 1089 this afternoon. And then I know that we have some folks that need to leave here shortly on HCR 6. So let's do HCR 6 and then go and take testimony on Senate Bill 1085. So I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 6. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us what we have?
Thank you, Madam Chair. HCR 6 extends sympathy to family, friends, students, and other people impacted by the life of Ronald S. Coyne.
Kind of to you. Thank you. Lieutenant Andrews, B.J. Smith. Good morning and welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Lieutenant Dixon Andrews, Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, representing Sheriff Craig Roberts. Thank you for allowing me to share a few minutes about Ron Coyne and HCR 6, the Ron Coyne Memorial Bill. Ron Coyne dedicated his life to public service, serving the citizens of Oregon. By vocation, Ron was a special ed teacher with the Portland Public Schools. In addition, Ron dedicated 22 years of his life volunteering on his own time as a reserve deputy with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and then the County Sheriff's Office. Ron never sought recognition or monetary reward. He was an ordinary man who maintained a selfless attitude of humble giving to our community. Towards the end of his life, when Ron couldn't work in the field, he spent countless hours training reserve officers for many local agencies in the Portland metro area. Ron's life was cut short because of medical issues, but he lived it fully in humble servitude. Deputy Ron Coyne was an ordinary man who chose to do extraordinary things that benefited the citizens of this state and of Clackamas County. On behalf of the Clackamas County Sheriff, Craig Roberts, the men and women of the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office, and Ron's widow, Claire Coyne, and their two sons, one of which is serving in Iraq right now, we ask for your support in passing this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just appreciate the comments from the Sheriff's Department and also ask you to pass the bill to the floor.
All right. Any questions for these folks? Thank you very much for joining us today. We appreciate your time and energy. Anybody else wishing to testify on HCR 6? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on HCR 6. All right, let's go back up to Senate Bill 1085. For the legislators I know that are working on this issue, please be assured we won't work this until the amendments are done, but we have a number of folks who are wishing to testify on the bill. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1085 modifies our statutory scheme governing medical marijuana. It modifies the amount of medical marijuana that an authorized person or designated primary caregiver may possess under certain circumstances.
Dr. Baer, Ms. Martinez, and Mr. Berger, why don't you come on up? And welcome.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Whoever wants to start.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I want to thank the chair and the committee for allowing me to testify. My name is Rick Baer, B-A-Y-E-R, M-D. I'm board certified in internal medicine and a fellow in the American College of Physicians. I was a chief petitioner, co-author, and spokesperson for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act that voters passed in 1998. I've co-authored a book on marijuana, Is Marijuana the Right Medicine for You? A Factual Guide to Uses of Marijuana, and I previously testified in Oregon state courts as an expert on medical cannabis. Among the committees that I served on, and I think I've served on all the Department of Human Services committees that had to do with medical marijuana, was a legislative advisory committee where Senator Bill Morissette asked members to try to reach a consensus bill. To make a long story short, this consensus bill has gone through lots of changes and is now before you as Senate Bill 1085-1. Unfortunately, some of us have some concerns primarily related to what's going on with we're still getting amendments that we're not quite sure about. We got some clarification yesterday afternoon, less than 24 hours before this. So although the potential for a good bill is here, I'm wondering if we're running out of time. For example, when I...
Dr. Baer, we can only hope we're running out of time, but I'm not sure that's the case.
Okay. Yes, that was just... That's only speculation on my part, for the record. The major problem that I see right now is a section in the bill that's called Section 8, Subsection 6, A through D. It's on page 7 of the printed bill, and it's specifically lines 15... through 23. Now, I'm not sure exactly how this amendment got into the bill, and I'm not sure that the other legislators know how it got in. At least they were not able to explain it to me. But
based the page number and
oh, I'm sorry. It's page on Senate Bill 1085 is page number 7.
Thanks.
And it's line 15.
Okay.
Through 23.
All right.
And what this section is it's a punishment section for patients who violate, which with the changes in the law could be as little as, well, gee, we grew as many plants as we did 3 or 4 years ago when it was 7, but now the new law says 6. So is this person going to be suspended for 5 years from getting access to medicine because they grew the same number of plants they could grow before this law was passed? So we don't expect all the patients in Oregon to read the medical marijuana laws as carefully as we do here, and we think there needs to be some leeway for people who make mistakes. We also think that this is an administrative punishment of pulling the card away after the person has already suffered the criminal justice punishment that might include arrest, it could include incarceration, and it could include parole where the patient's unable to use medical marijuana during this. And this is only the criminal justice issues before we even come to the administrative penalties. There is already in the law an administrative penalty where a person can lose their card for up to 6 months. But now this would be a card loss for 5 years. This would be denying access to a medical marijuana patient, denying access to pain medicine for 5 years because one of their plants was 13 inches instead of 12, or they had 7 instead of 6. Now, denying access to pain medicine for a physician, we unequivocally call that unethical, and I want to get that on the record. Physicians call denying access of pain medication to sick people unethical. In fact, the American Medical Association makes it very clear that doctors are obligated to treat pain even in enemy combatants. So what this law actually does, as written, is it creates a new category of registrant who is not really a patient who can access medicine if they violate. This patient, as it's called, must buy the medicine on the black market or beg from other cardholders. The registry ID without someone to grow the medicine is not access to medicine, and this means that SB 1085-1, as interpreted by legislative counsel, denies access to pain medicine for sick people, forces sick people back into the black market. I could support this if we could entirely remove Section 8, Sub 6, A through D. If we could entirely remove that...
Okay, could you say that again, sir?
Yes. I would support this legislation if we could entirely remove Section 8, Subsection 6, A through D. That's the double jeopardy patient punishment record. That's
the... Excuse me, you said A through
C.
Yeah, you said
A
through...
Well, that's because the Dash 1 amendment...
Got it. All right. Ooh, you're good. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
So what that section is it is the administrative punishment that patients get in addition to the criminal justice punishment, and that administrative punishment actually denies access to pain medicine, which I don't think is the intention of the committee. So I think this is just a mistake that we haven't gotten around to fixing yet.
Okay.
So basically, patients are already getting punished by automatic card suspension, possible jail time, followed by probation. And by this section, it throws people into the hands of the black market, and we can fix that, and we can have a good consensus bill if we remove that section. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I'd be very happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Martinez?
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you so much. My name is Madeline Martinez. I am a patient advocate, and I'm also the director of Oregon Normal, the executive director. And Normal is the national organization for the reform of marijuana laws, and this is the biggest reform in marijuana law in 30 years, medical marijuana. I'm here today because I worked closely with Senator Morrison and the Human Services Committee to try to move this bill along that would enhance the lives of disabled Oregonians. Unfortunately, as Dr. Bear already stated, it has taken a bad turn with language that would be punitive to patients, almost in a double jeopardy position for them to be penalized. And I've worked in prisons in the state of California for the Department of Corrections, and I've never seen a convicted murderer denied pain medicine. And this is really terrifying to me to think that disabled Oregonians would face such punitive measures.
Ms. Martinez, is Dr. Baer and Mr. Berger. My understanding of the amendments that are being drafted and the reason why we weren't planning to work the bill is that the language, I believe on line 15, again, this is only conversations in the hallway, was changing the shall to a may. I don't know whether or not that addresses your concerns, but you should also be aware that we've received a note from the law enforcement community that if that happens, or Dr. Baer, your suggestion happens, they're probably going to oppose the bill. So I guess my suggestion is you have three legislators that are very interested in moving this bill, Senators Morissette, Senators Prezanski, and Senator Jeff Cruz. I'm happy to sort of finish your testimony, but that's sort of the issue the committee is wrestling with right now, is whether or not we can address your concerns at the same time addressing the concerns of law enforcement and get the legislators on board. So.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Berger?
Thank you, Chair Brown, committee members. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. I represent patients and caregivers statewide. I've represented patients and caregivers in 16 counties, from Ashland to Astoria and from Brookings to Baker City. I think we have already run out of time. I think the concerns that I have with this bill go beyond the concerns that Dr. Baer and Ms. Martinez have described, and they are, I'd like to articulate them for you briefly if
that's
I could.
That's fine. That's totally fine.
Okay. And I am, if you need, I can come back at 1 o'clock today.
Okay.
But just briefly, and it's it begins on the same page, aside from this this revocation system, the next section was added following the public hearing on the Dash 4 amendments to 772, which was the precursor to this. And it changes what we've understood to be the existing rules relative to what is or is not a transfer for consideration to unnecessarily limit what agreements patients and caregivers can reach, and it does that in a way that will result in less access to medicine for patients. More patients will be without medicine if subsection 7 of section 8, which appears on page 7 at lines 24 through 29, remains. Section 9, subsection 1, which increases the existing limits from 3 mature plants and 4 immature plants, 1 ounce per mature plant at the location of the garden, 1 ounce away from the garden, to 6 mature plants and 24 ounces of usable marijuana, sounds like, you know, significant increase. The problem is twofold. First, the goal was to address what was unaddressed in the 98 legislation as amended in 99, which is the rural outdoor once a year growers. As it came out of the Legislative Advisory Committee, it provided for 64 ounces, and it was a voluntary waiver of the affirmative defense. Here, the affirmative defense has been repealed, and what the people who are once-a-year cultivators are telling all of us is that the 24 ounces is inadequate in the absence of an affirmative defense. The second thing that I told the Human Services Committee was a deal breaker is the limitation in Section 9, Subsection 2C, may produce marijuana for up to 4 registry identification cardholders or designated primary caregivers a year. Under current law, there's no limit to the number of people that a designated primary caregiver can provide medicine for. And again, this would restrict safe access to this medicine. The third problem that I have is on page 9, at section 12, subsection 3. This is the existing law, the 98 initiative as amended by the 99 legislature. But the problem is that given the absence of the affirmative defense for cardholders, and a decision by the Court of Appeals in a case, State versus Miles, M-I-L-E-S, a couple of months ago, a choice of evils defense really isn't available to people for cultivating because you have to show imminence. So we need to, it cries out for a legislative fix. And in that regard, this bill originated in health services, which is a good thing because it's about health. But the problem is that there's a series of criminal justice reforms that are needed. I spend a lot of time in a lot of counties arguing about whether a probationer can use medical cannabis while they're on probation, if they're a cardholder or not. That's the kind of thing that could be handled legislatively. The parole boards come up with a policy for people on parole and post-prison supervision, but there is no policy for DUI diversion or for release pending trial. I've communicated primarily with Senator Prezonsky while this bill's been working its way along, but have shared with the three senators you describe, as along with Representative March, who's also been working on this bill, that you know, my view is that we have run out of time, that if we had an interim legislative advisory committee that included legislators, I think we'd be able to accomplish something next session, but I just don't think we can this session. What happened between last session and this session is there was a bill that was originated in the House last session that passed out of the House that was where the program and law enforcement had agreed to certain reforms that Senator Morissette didn't give a hearing to, directed the state health officer to create a legislative advisory committee, and the one that Dr. Baer and Ms. Martinez described to you. But there weren't any legislators on it. And at the last meeting the law enforcement just didn't show up at all. So,
you hear those bills.
For all these reasons, Madam Chair and committee members, I encourage you to not move this bill forward and to allow some additional time between now and the next session to see what we can do to iron out these other necessary changes.
I'm like, what if the session just sort of never ends and we just sort of keep going until next session?
I know sometimes, Madam Chair, that it feels that way, especially coming into the 4th of July weekend here. But I wish you and everyone else a speedy end to the session.
Thank you. Questions?
Multiple questions.
All right.
I think most legislators are pretty sympathetic to the idea that there are people that need pain medication. And we've wrestled with this on a variety of fronts, and one of them certainly been sanctions for doctors who fail to prescribe medication in palliative amounts. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got a very sort of a bifurcated approach to palliative medications, and most doctors have been reared in the idea that you just don't over-medicate your patients. And sometimes they err in judgment by failure to provide enough medication to alleviate pain. On the other hand, we've got some really clear statutes about substance abuse, and that's ORS 475.992 and providing, you know, what happens to people who could be described as garden variety dealers and pushers. The problem we have is that with the authorizations for medical marijuana and the counterpoint that we're trying to get out there, making distinctions between palliative medications and meth. You know, a use by an individual who qualifies under medical care and one who just uses. And then the conflicting philosophies that some marijuana is medical and all marijuana is medical.
Yes.
Right? Now, you've all heard those things. There's a button, all marijuana is medical. Well, the problem for our society and law enforcement is we've got to draw a clear distinction. And the objections that you're having that you've expressed in 1085 deal with ORS 475.992, and those are controlled substance statutes and prohibitions against delivery and production of controlled substances. Now, the medical marijuana card provides an affirmative defense, but the cops need to know how to make the distinction. How am I going to answer the police? A law enforcement need to be able to make a clear distinction between those that are illegally growing or possessing because they've got a card and those that are just dealing out the back door and they've got a card for cover.
Well, I think that the one section that I discussed in 8, subsection 6, I think we first need to remember that that section has not been there since 1998 and the world has not fallen apart. So I'm not sure that patients need an additional administrative punishment in addition to the criminal justice issue because they get punished enough criminal justice-wise, and that may be a matter of debate. Not everybody feels that way, but certainly I do because I've seen it happen and I've had to help patients with that. Secondly, if the intention was that you have a patient who just cannot get it together enough to follow the law to grow their own marijuana, then the answer is not to restrict access to that patient. The answer is to say, you can't grow, but we can find someone who's got a clean record, like a caregiver or a grower who doesn't have any criminal record, and they can grow for you. And actually, this is what I was under the impression the law said, and this is what Mr. Berkobian, the administrator, was under the impression that the law said when we talked yesterday afternoon and said, oops, we better get an opinion from legislative counsel. So you see, it's sort of like if they wanted to say this patient is too irresponsible to grow, they could say you can't grow, but this caregiver or this other grower who's got a clean record and we know won't break the law because they haven't broken it, they can grow for you and supply you, but you can't grow yourself. And see, that would be an alternative that would say we don't want a patient to grow because they haven't shown that they can follow the law. But the way it's written now, it's like we're going to say that someone can't follow the law. We're going to deny you access to pain medicine. So there's a really easy little compromise, and I think that's what the Senate Human Services Committee tried to do with the Dash 1 amendments that came out Monday morning, was to fix that area. That's why it's in that section that we're discussing. And my point is that it's just not fixed yet, that it could be fixed. And the reason I was suggesting pulling the language is because I knew that if we went back to the way the Oregon medical marijuana law is right now, or was last week, at least we're not going to create unintended consequences. That's why I made that suggestion. But if I thought somebody could fix it with dash threes and dash fours and dash fives, so we could get to the point where we're only keeping the patient from growing, because I think that's what the intention is, don't you? They want to keep the patient from growing.
Doctor, I think there is a variety of intentions here, but let me try to give you a little counterpoint here.
Okay.
The description, the example that you used of the patient who's confused and their illness may cause that problem, or even the medication can, and they grow a plant that's an inch taller than the state statute allows, then they'd be subject to criminal prosecution. That's about the most benign example I could come up with or think of. You know, it's simply a 24-hour period of inattention and the plant gets 2 centimeters taller than the law allows. And an overzealous or perhaps just vigilant neighbor says, you know, turns him in, or the grower. And you've got then a criminal case on your hands. And that could result in the suspension or revocation of the card. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got people dealing drugs. It's a criminal enterprise. There's a lot of money in it. You know, I don't know what the street value of an ounce, I don't even know if you buy it in ounces, but a street value of marijuana is, but I understand that from reading the seizure reports, it seems like a fairly low volume can have an exceedingly high street value. So at some point in time, we have to admit there are people out there who get a card just to be able to deal dope. And those people, once they get popped, should lose that card. Or do you disagree with that?
I think that the people who are egregiously violating should lose the ability to grow, but they should not lose access to medicine. For example, that's why I put in there that I've taken care of convicted murderers in hospitals that are handcuffed to the beds, but we still give them pain medicine. So if we can give pain medicine to convicted murderers, how come we can't give pain medicine to somebody who had a 13-inch plant?
You know, doctor, I think that's an excellent question, and I think any compassionate person would agree that we shouldn't deny palliative medications to people that need them. There are cases where people have cards, medical marijuana cards, because they suffer anxiety. Okay. I think there's deep suspicion, at least among some people, that these cards are available for conditions that are otherwise treatable, and that may, in fact, just be accessible to folks that find doctors who are just willing to write prescriptions for the cards. I mean, we have, I think, one physician that writes most of the cards in the state of Oregon. Is that you, by the way?
No, sir, no. It's not. I've never written for a card. But that was a good question.
All right. But the point I'm trying to make here is that there is an attempt to come to a balance point where you don't have people just accessing this program in order to have legal cover for dealing drugs.
Right. And
those people should not be allowed to maintain a card or to produce marijuana, in my opinion.
Right.
And I'm not capable of making the determination. But I want the folks in law enforcement not to have their hands tied when they find those cases and can prove those cases administratively in a court of law.
But if we both agree that those people should not be able to grow their medicine, do we both agree that those people should have access to pain medicine?
Yeah, I think that's the rub.
And I think that there would be a compromise that could be set up so that those patients couldn't grow, but could still have access to pain medicine through a person who has not violated and who allocates such small quantities to the patient that the patient really can't conduct a commercial operation that the law enforcement would be concerned about. They would only be allocated quantities that would cover their symptoms.
Well, Dr. Lang, 15 through 23, the section that you're referring to, section 6, I believe it is, on page 7. Is that the section?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Those all have to do with production. Is that not right?
Well, not exactly. They have to do with restricting the grow card, which actually not only has to do with production, but it has to do with access. Because if it only had to do with production by the patient, that means that the patient could get someone else to produce it, or there would be ideally there would be a registry or a pharmacy where a patient could go access it so they wouldn't have to have all these little gardens all over the state. But actually, Section 6 decreases access to medicine for sick and dying Oregonians.
But every one of those sections has the words grow site.
I believe you.
Grow site registration. So I think it's about production that we need to have the question. I'm going to ask the other panel for some help here. Senator Ringo, do you have a question?
Well, Senator Farrelly, I think you are doing a very good job of getting to the crux of it. Frankly, I am sympathetic with the concerns you raise. You know, everybody deserves medical care. There's lots of kinds of medical care. For some people, they prefer to use medical marijuana, and I appreciate that, and I'm fine with that. But it seems to me if they've run afoul of the law for violating marijuana laws, if they violated marijuana laws, maybe it is going to be harder for them to avail themselves of that kind of treatment, and that's just the way it's going to be. Because I think Senator Ferrioli's concerns are exactly right. Somebody can get a card, and they're really dealing out of the back of their house. And so you can talk about the compassion, and I'm a bleeding heart liberal, believe me. But at some point you need to be able to say to people, you know, you violated the law, and now there are going to be restrictions on the type of medical care you're going to get.
May I respond?
Sure.
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, and Senator Ringo. The statutes that would cause the revocation to occur are statutes that prohibit manufacture and delivery. Under Oregon law, delivery includes possession with intent to deliver. So anytime there are a few plants too many, the state charges and is able to convict on delivery. People plead to delivery because delivery is an expungible offense when manufacturing is not, whether they're actually delivering or not, because our statutes allow no contest pleas. So people are able to take advantage of that. Senator Farrelly, you're correct that the revocation would be of the grow site registration card, and that the patient would still have a patient ID card. But what Dr. Baer is trying to explain is that they would be such patients would thus be dependent on the charitable goodwill of other cardholders, or more likely, required to return to the underground market that you described. Now, I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act. I helped write Measure 33, which garnered 43% of the vote at the last election. And I've been doing this work for 8 years, and I haven't seen the kind of abuses that law enforcement comes here and talks about. In fact, In 2001, Lieutenant Durbin's predecessor, Larry Welty, came and spoke about all the abuses and was asked by a legislator, well, how many abuses have there been in the 4 years? And he said, oh, probably no more than 50, so 12 a year, you know. It was 12 abuses, 12 at that time. So the kinds of fears that you have, Senator Perioli and Senator Ringo, aren't
real. They're not actually happening. That's the problem. But instead, what happens is the people who get caught up are the people who always get caught up, and it's and then the other piece of it is that we never
social Darwinism.
Well,
thing, isn't it?
Senator Farioli, the other thing we never talk about and never hear about from. Well, let me back up a half a step. One, you know, the advocates don't often speak with one voice, but one thing that where we've been able to speak with one voice and agree with law enforcement on is that we want law enforcement to have some bright line rules. It benefits everybody for law enforcement. I mean, there's a part of this bill that includes 24/7. That's being implemented by the Department of Human Services as we speak, that law enforcement will be able to verify who is or is not, irrespective of whether this legislation goes forward. That's going to happen. This legislation calls for an advisory committee. There already is an advisory committee, whether this legislation goes forward or not.
Well, let me.
That's going to continue, but they never talk, Senator Farioli, just to finish the sentence.
Now, let me interrupt your testimony and say, I think you've made some good points here, and I appreciate all your testimony, and Dr. Bear, thank you for being here. Ms. Martinez, you also. Since we've invoked the name of Mr. Durbin, let's bring him up for the OSP and hear the other side of the story.
I just wanted to finish my sentence,
please,
if I could, please. The problem is that what you won't hear from Lieutenant Durbin, and you won't hear from anybody in law enforcement, is the extent to which the Medical Marijuana Act has taken patients out from the underground market. And to the extent that, you know, marijuana is whatever it is, $4,000 a pound, if you multiply that times 10,000 patients times 6 pounds a year or whatever it is, you know, we're talking some significant dollars that are no longer part of the underground market because of the Medical Marijuana Act. And I hope that you would focus on that.
Let's not do a commercial building the interest in people in the underground market. Those numbers are stunning, and yes, it's a good thing that we're getting people out of the underground market.
But the provision that Dr. Baer is concerned about would force those patients back to the underground market.
You made the point.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Baer.
Thank you.
Mr. Durbin, please.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Vice Chair Senator Farioli and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin, and I'm a lieutenant with Oregon State Police and currently the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. Mm-hmm. And I as well sat on the Legislative Advisory Committee with the program during the last, about a year and a half. And it is true that at that time, towards the end of that, prior to session, law enforcement did walk away from the table, and there was a variety of reasons that we felt that there was wanting the advocacy side, particularly. And you have to understand there's actually three different camps. There's a law enforcement camp. There's the two different advocacy groups. One really does want the expansion of the program considerably. The other one feels what you see in this bill is, in fact, a good bill, and it's plenty of medicine, and the things that are in this bill are actually good as well. And there was three different groups on this committee, and we did work to attempt to try to come to some compromise, but one of the groups that wanted the continual expansion did not also see some of the bright lines that law enforcement wanted. So at that time, we felt that we needed to go ahead and walk away from the table and try to handle it through the legislature. Law enforcement has been asking, we've been working on and attempting to understand what our position and role is within the program. We've also been trying to balance what we see as very needed changes to the program with the needs of those in the program. And one thing that law enforcement does know is that there needs to be very bright lines in this program. We've said that all along, that there needs to be bright lines. Currently, there are many gray areas that cause problems for law enforcement and the cardholders, and recently law enforcement was actually going through tort claims because that we were taking medicine when cardholders were not in possession of their cards, and then we were being asked to return that medicine based on the Ninth Circuit Court ruling that has since now changed. This bill, we're actually very supportive of as it is written. We've been working for, again, about the last year, and particularly the last 6 months with the senators, and trying to help them understand the law enforcement needs and the things that we were seeing out into the field and the areas that we were coming into that caused us to have a lot of, depending on what county you're in, depending on what action that you took, and then even when you took that action, you still were not sure where you stood. And so it's a very complicated issue, but again, the current draft does solve a lot of the things that we felt needed to be solved. in the area of this one area here under line 6, the department shall revoke marijuana grow site, is very important, and we feel it is one of those bright lines that we need within this program. Currently, that language says that they may suspend a card for 6 months, but we know very few times that those cards are actually suspended. Now, they do suspend some of them that are pretty egregious, but again, if you were to take and change that to a may revoke, the problem with that is, who's going to make that determination? How are you going to make that determination? Are you going to do it for a plant that's 1 inch tall? Are you going to do it for 10 plants? Are you going to do it for 20 plants? What are you going to do? But again, it gets back to the arbitrary decisions that are made instead of creating very clear, bright lines. One of the things that this bill does is it also expands a new classification of a person that's allowed to grow the marijuana. They call it a grower. Well, that we were willing to do that even though we're going to be letting people come into Oregon specifically just to grow marijuana that really have no responsibility other than to grow marijuana. They don't have responsibility for caretaking of the patient or any of those type of responsibilities. And we said, well, if that's the case, then we need to make sure that when those people come in and they're in the program, that they realize that if they're in the program as a cover, they violate the program, there's going to be severe repercussions based on that. Now, we do not agree as law enforcement that patients should not have their marijuana. We don't agree with that. And there is a dash one amendment that I've seen, and that dash one would make it so that the, in this case, that the card holder or the patient would still be allowed to have access to the marijuana. However, they would not be allowed to grow. And so they would obtain a grower or a caregiver to grow that marijuana for them. They would still have access to their marijuana. So this would cause those repercussions on specifically a person that's convicted, that then after the conviction they're revoked for 5 years and they get one more chance. And we believe that's more than fair. They still get another chance. If you don't do that, you will have scenarios, what we currently have, where a person could have 300-400 plants, or even let's say 50 plants are over the limit. They, if you put that may, they might not be revoked, suspended, or anything, and they go through the criminal process. They then are charged and convicted within the criminal process, and at that time, they come right back in, obtain their card, and start growing again. So we think that this needs to stay in there. It needs to stay in there as it is, and maybe with the amendment that would allow the patient to continue to access the medicine. I think, Senator Farioli, you're right that this is for grow site registration. It is not for the card holder who, with that card holder gives them the criminal law exemptions that allows them to use and possess their marijuana.
Questions from the committee? I'm going to go ahead and just recess the hearing on 1085 and ask the various interested parties to step into the hallway and get a better understanding of what's in the body of the bill. I think there's a clear indication to me that there's a disconnect between what is actually in lines 15 through 23, section 8, page 7. And if you could come to a better understanding, that might add some clarity to this issue. It's been communicated to me that the Association of Oregon Chiefs of Police, the District Attorneys Association, the Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon State Police support Senate Bill 1085 in its printed form. I think you risk the support of that organization if you ask for the amendments that turn shall to may. And I would hate to lose the work of the committee if that was the case. So we'll go ahead and recess the hearing on Senate Bill 1085. I've asked the proponents to have a hallway conversation about their understanding about what's in the printed version of the bill, and we may reconvene. I would like to have a moment with the staff here.
I think she'll
find. Okay. We're going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 1089 and ask the folks from the Department of the Treasury to come forward. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Kate Richardson, Chief of Staff for Oregon State Treasurer, and Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer.
Welcome. We had some, and I'm hoping that you listened to this morning's testimony on 1089. Would you care to respond for the record?
Yes, and I will preface that with saying that the treasurer does have a meeting with Senator Carter and the proponents today at 2 o'clock today to discuss the bill and potential amendments to it. Stepping back and not to discuss the issue of Sudan at this point in time, but just the issue of the legislature and bills that direct investment or divestment by the legislature directly rather than through the Oregon Investment Council. It is the treasurer's general position that he does oppose bills that mandate investment or divestment of investment. The Oregon Investment Council was created just for that evaluative purpose and has that fiduciary responsibility placed on them for that. And so as a general principle, and you've seen us here on other bills in the past, on other issues, he does oppose that. That said, it's not to disagree or argue at all with the horrific situation that exists in Sudan. I did want to place that on the record. One thing, and Senator Brown did ask me to bring this up, there will be, as this bill is written, there would be a fiscal impact because of this bill, and so she did want me to put that on the record. We also wanted to identify that there would be another impact, a financial impact, not registered in our fiscal impact statement, but there would be a financial impact that would result from the implementation of this bill. We've been taking a look at it and have this is a very complex issue. It's a very complex financial world out there, and we are trying to understand even what the implementation of this bill could even look like so that we could present that information to you and to the proponents. As this bill is written, and Linda can probably fill in here a little bit more, it reaches all state monies, and that includes debt programs, the investment of debt proceeds. It impacts trust funds, and even we believe at this point it reaches into local government monies or the short-term fund and the deferred comp program as well. There's some tension created in this bill between between the fiduciary. There's an affirmative statement that says it does not affect the fiduciary responsibility and yet does requires a prudent execution of the sections of the bill. That creates a tension, and we're not sure that can be easily resolved. And we also, and it's our understanding from preliminary counsel too, that despite the statement that it does not affect fiduciary responsibility, it would reach into areas of the investment counsel's fiduciary responsibility. Do you want to go ahead and?
You know, for the record, Linda Haglund, Deputy State Treasurer. I might offer to the committee, since we do have the meeting this afternoon and we haven't had the opportunity to meet with Senator Carter, it might be better use of your time for us to have that meeting, get a clear understanding of the intent of the proponents of the bill, and make sure and work with them that those are actually delivered in the text. As Kate has mentioned, there is some tension in the bill. It is drafted differently than the South Africa bill back in 87 assembly. Some very minor changes, but those are significant differences. And we're not clear with, again, the drafters of the bill if that was an intended consequence that they had. So I might offer to the committee, instead of trying to go through those specifics, allow us to have that meeting and then come back at a later time.
Questions from the committee? Senator Shields.
Have you compared this bill with the bills passed by the state of Louisiana and Arizona and several other states that have bills in the process? I know those two have gone to the governor and have been signed already. Have you done any of that work?
Not by my mind. We Mr. Chair, Senator Shields. We have looked more line by line at the Illinois bill, and that bill is mirrored, its language is mirrored in a similar concept in the House bill, House Bill 3499. The Louisiana bill we have looked at line by line. I mean, conceptually, we know that different states are doing different things, and California has a different suggestion entirely, but all on the topic. We have been in the process of gathering those, looking at what other states are doing legislatively, but also what alternatives, and this is something we also wanted to talk with the proponents about too, what alternatives exist that are non-legislative, and what tools do we already have that can meet some of the objectives of this bill already, that the Investment Council already has at its disposal. So, yes and no.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
One of the representatives that presented this morning in testimony pointed out that this is, well, what I just in my head thought was about 1.5% of our investment. That's relatively small. Can you comment on that? I mean, you seem to be saying that the impacts were quite large. I'm trying to understand that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, just as a little bit of background, I believe that the numbers on which that was based is on a report that we haven't been able to that got quite a bit of publicity some months ago, and we're not sure on which companies. They would not identify which companies even that they're basing their analysis of our fund on, so we have not done that same analysis and necessarily have the same numbers. That said, go ahead.
And if I may continue with that, Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the report that contains the 1% or 1.5%, that was specific to the retirement fund. The bill as crafted also impacts or covers, I should say, the Common School Fund, SAFE, higher ed, veterans deposits with us, all the bond programs, the proceeds that are invested there, all state funds, including programs that we run that local governments also invest in. So I would just compare what the bill is saying relative to the number that is being cited is a very small part of the bill's coverage.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, 1.5% so of even of the PERS fund is a very large number.
Final question. Even if it's 2% or 3% or 5% of our fund, would the Investment Council itself be willing to look at the fact that you don't want to invest in a company or a country that's seriously involved in genocide and has killed a couple million people? I mean, I don't understand. Certainly there are good investments around the world without investing in such a regime. I don't understand. Actually, I don't understand the logic at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, the council is by statute required to look at all investments in the management of funds with the two standards of prudence and production. Clearly within that analysis by all of our managers is risk. And it's incumbent on our managers, and we measure them on not just their performance, but also the analysis processes that they have in place to examine the risk of their investments. So I guess I would say to a certain extent that mechanism is already in place, and it's incumbent on our investment managers to make that call and make that balance decision. So while I'm not answering directly, would the council be receptive or not, because we have not asked them that question. And it also has, again, relative to the statutory directive of how they can manage the funds and must manage the funds, the standards that they must apply. We would need to do some more research to come back to you to give you the parameters within which they could make that call. I can say, though, that the council is proactive in making sure that the tools that are in their control are implemented consistent with investment guidelines, and that is through proxy voting. And the council has a position, as does the treasurer, that the best way for managers, or one of the best ways for managers to adequately evaluate investments, is to have full information. So the council's proxy voting process is that proxies that promote information disclosure by companies, which would be included investment in Sudan, you know, any other types of programs or any other issues, is disclosed by companies such that our managers are to evaluate that risk and make that call to invest or not invest. So that is something that is already going on.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, to that as well, we have not had this issue presented directly to the Oregon Investment Council at this point in time, but they are now aware of this bill as well. And that is, I would put that in one of the alternatives that may exist for our conversation with the proponents, too.
Question, Senator Ringo.
Thank you. You said this bill has a fiscal. How much?
Senator Farrelly, Senator Ringo, we don't know that. No one's asked us for a fiscal. And so we can't tell you right off the bat what that would be. We believe it would probably have a FTE impact on our office. And this does put a heavy burden on the treasurer as far as coordinating across the state. But it would reach out into many other agencies.
I'm just going to hazard a couple of guesses here. The reinvestment clauses, the mutual fund aspect, the cross-collateralization of companies that may hold a secondary interest. It'll take you a long time to figure out where the dollars are coming from and where they're going. So disinvesting is not just as easy as selling all your shares in something that's obviously connected. It's doing the primary, secondary, and tertiary research to look for those companies that may have secondary interests that aren't immediately evident, you know, by the name of the company or the principal holding. So that creates a problem. I'm going to ask you to do something proactive. If the disinvestment were to be made on a proactive basis, that is no new investment, would that change the approach that you'd have?
Mr. Chair, yes, it would. For purely the investment funds,
right.
The way the bill is crafted right now, it does cover also management of debt programs and debt reserves.
Right.
And many of, I don't know enough about how those contracts are set up.
Right, and then reinvestment would be another issue. I think
right.
If you could be ready to discuss those issues at 2 p.m., you'd really be serving this process. Yes, you'll be in a minute here. So I'm going to go ahead and dismiss this panel if there's no other questions. Senator Shields?
I don't know if this is a question or just a comment, but you talked about full information. And Representative Boquist was in here, and he actually took this photograph and had a lot of stuff. Full information, like we got this morning, is enough to make some of us want to throw up. Okay, literally. And it seems to me that too often an investment council or a treasurer's office or whatever lives in kind of a sanitized atmosphere compared to the real carnage that's out there. And somehow I'm just wanting to urge you to really immerse yourself in some, quote-unquote, to use your words, full information about what's going on there.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, to that, I absolutely agree. It makes all of us sick. Mm-hmm. All of us sick. But my point here would be the full information is to even understanding what companies, what exposure we even would or don't have. And at this point, there's not a simple list out here. There is some criteria here. We don't know what our exposure would even be based on that.
Senator Shields, a lot of people, myself included, have some difficulty with the international sugar industry. You know, and if you get into the geopolitical prospects or the geopolitical issues of sugar production and distribution, and then make the decision you're not going to invest in sugar, you would have a very difficult time finding what would be left to invest in. So, I mean, just pointing out, I can see some complexity here, and if you would try to get ahead of the issue, or maybe narrow the question of what could you do proactively that makes a strong statement about how we invest and bring that to the meeting at 2, I think you might be serving the process. Meantime, I see a gentleman who has come here from Senator Carter's staff. I'd like to call him forward.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They have a tough job.
Mm-hmm. We never told him anything.
Yeah, I know. We're going to recess in about 4 or 5 minutes. We have a floor session starting at 10.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief. For the record, my name is John Christensen, and I am Chief of Staff in Senator Carter's office. Also, for the information of the committee, I was the principal drafter of the South African divestiture legislation. The model you have before you is based on the dialogue that occurred between our office and the office of the State Treasurer Bill Rutherford. There's very little difference in the two bills. With regard to fiscal impact, I have provided the record of fiscal impact to Inga Deckard, which the State Treasurer's Office does have, I believe. It's also available through archives. And I think the FTE was one person or one and a half FTE. Okay? And this is substantially less financially than South Africa. Because as far as I know, there are no investments right now in Sudan. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, we have a floor session at 10 a.m. this morning. The chair asked us to proceed until 2:40. Is there anyone here that wants to add additional testimony to Senate Bill 1085 or 1089? We're going to read. Yes, sir.
I know that Kevin Neely of DOJ has been sitting here, I think, on the dash 13. Okay, I just want to check that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Ringo. We're going to go ahead and recess the committee hearing. I'm going to recess it to the call of the chair, and that would give the chairman the ultimate opportunity to bring us back together, and we'll convey that to the chairman when we see her on the Senate floor. There being no further business, we are in recess to the call of the chair.